Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. My name is Lee Davey. I'm not an alcoholic. I refuse to be anonymous. I'm someone that doesn't drink alcohol, and I spend every waking moment of my life helping other people do the same. Today, my guest is Lisa Erlandsen. Lisa is a licensed Thrive consultant for the Thrive program based in Bournemouth, as well as seeing clients remotely via online sessions. She helps people to overcome the issues that are holding them back in life, whether that's drinking, smoking, phobias, fears, depression, anxiety, you know, the usual kind of thing that drags us down in life. And she helps them to build a life that they love again, where they are thriving. She's been alcohol-free for nearly 2.5 years and is keen to raise awareness of alcohol-related issues, including fundraising through her Year of Fear for charities Alcohol Change UK and Action on Addiction. Before working as a Thrive consultant, Lisa had a successful career for many years in the political field, both nationally in Westminster and locally in Bournemouth, as well as working in PR and lobbying. In this episode, we learn about Lisa's struggles with alcohol, what worked for her at Thrive, for example, and what didn't work for her going to rehab. Her experience with emetophobia, never heard of that one before, dealing with anxiety and social issues, which is a big problem for many of us. And she also talks about her year of living through fear, which is really inspiring and encouraging, and her experiences as a Thrive consultant. If you would like to get hold of Lisa Erlandsen, then send me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll point her in her direction. Without further ado, I'm going to shut the hell up and leave you in the capable hands of Lisa Erlandsen.
Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast, Lisa Erlandsen. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm fabulous. Where's our second name from, Erlandsen?
My dad is Norwegian.
Your dad is Norwegian. Yeah, have you been to that part of the world?
Yeah, we go quite a lot. I'm going in a couple of weeks, actually, because we've got another family wedding. So, yeah, I go out quite a lot.
I think I have this vision. I think it's not on my bucket list, but I need this Scandinavian tour where I see all these hills and these beautiful deep fjords and...
Oh. You have to go. It's just beautiful. As a country, it's just peaceful and everyone's lovely. Yeah, you have to go.
I will, especially now my daughter's into Frozen, so I think that would be like the perfect area. Right, we're gonna get, normally when people go on podcasts, the host gently encourages people to kind of like come into it very gently. I don't do that. I hit the ground running by asking you some complicated icebreakers. You ready? Ooh.
I'm ready.
So here are some questions from a book of questions called Know Yourself from the School of Life. Shuffling now, and I'm going to stop at random and ask you one, right?
Okay, I'm on it.
If you don't want to ask it, if you don't want to answer it, just say fold.
Okay.
If you could consider yourself dispassionately, what might you warn a friend about if they were thinking of starting a relationship with you?
I'm stubborn. Really.
You're stubborn?
Yeah.
Give me an example of your stubbornness, Lisa.
I don't like to lose. I really don't like to lose. So I think if you caught me on a game of Monopoly and you broke the rules, there would be hell to pay until you realised you were wrong.
Are you one of these people who calls arguments debates?
Yes. But I like to think they're healthy debates because, you know, everyone should debate. Why shouldn't you? I think when you're frightened to debate, that's a problem. But I do have to watch my stubbornness and sometimes rein it in.
that sounds like I have that trait. What sort of things have made you envious recently?
Oh, travelling pictures. Genuinely. So one of my best friends is in Australia at the minute, travelling for the year. And I'm looking after her cats, so as a favour to her. So I feel like the cat lady at home, and I'm there watching all her amazing Instagram posts of her overseas, so I'm getting a little bit envious. She's just got back from, just a weekend in Fiji. So, very jealous, yeah.
just a weekend in Fiji. I'm going to go there in a minute and ask you to talk about your history with anxiety and depression and low self-esteem. So let's start with social media. I mean, you look fairly young. You look a lot younger than I am. I mean, talk about your history, but also blend that in. Has social media had an impact in any way in that?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the biggest thing was that when I was growing up, mental health wasn't really talked about as much as it was. So I was quite an anxious stress head at school. And I just thought that was normal. I just thought that every kid gets as stressed as I got about exams. So I never associated that it was anything other than it should be. I thought the way I was reacting was normal. And then I knew that I, at university, I struggled a bit when I first got there in terms of worrying I wouldn't fit in and all the rest of it. And I used drink a lot to cope with that. And I think that was the first time that I associated drink with managing that anxiety. You know, it was like the dots connected in my head. And so then I started using it for other stuff. So I had quite low self-esteem, not because I wasn't doing well, but because I was just never seeing anything I did as good enough, you know. So I was actually a bit of an overachiever at university and at school, but I always thought I was a failure, just completely lost connection with reality. And I think these things kind of snowballed. So, you know, the anxiety got worse, the low self-esteem got worse, eating problems started kicking in. I had huge fears around food and sickness and anything related to that. And so I would start to use drink more and more to cope with that. And of course, as we all know, you know, alcohol doesn't necessarily help when you're starting to feel low. And I think where I really noticed, I would probably never have said I had depression, but I must have done. You know, I felt so low and at times pretty suicidal. And a huge part of that was that I graduated and this university bubble I'd been living in just kind of fell apart. You know, we were all growing up and getting jobs and I didn't like that. I wanted to see my friends all the time and I associated drinking with having fun and going out. And I felt boring and I felt like I was missing out. And social media was definitely a part of that. I definitely think I spent a lot of time scrolling through thinking everyone had it better than I did. And that was potentially the first time I started to realize that maybe this wasn't how everyone felt, you know, or that maybe I just had a particularly screwed up brain or something like that. So I think that was the part where I started to go downhill a bit and just lower and lower. And the worse I got, the worse my eating got, the more my anxiety got, the more I drank to cope with it. And I, you know, it's strange now looking back on it, how I didn't see it coming, it wasn't that I woke up one day and just, as we all know, just suddenly started drinking a huge amount. It would be, you know, I'd start with going out once or twice a week after work. Then it might be three times. Then it would be getting in at 4 o'clock in the morning before I was starting work at eight. Then it would be drinking in the morning occasionally to get me out of bed and over the hangover. And then it might be going for a little lunchtime drink. And, you know, it just kind of snowballed very gently.
It's almost like we talk in Strive about, not, we don't use the term alcoholics. We say that everybody in the world is on the alcohol spectrum somewhere. And if you look at that spectrum and think to yourself, there's only a very, very small proportion of people who actually fit into the stereotype of the alcoholic, right? Yeah. Everybody else is kind of flitting in and around on that thing. And the other people who don't fit into that stereotype, they never think they have a problem until they try to stop. And then when they try to stop, they realize, oh, fuck, like, I can't go a couple of days without drinking. This is a problem. Is it like that with you?
Yeah, definitely. I think I just always assumed, my doorbell's about to go in a sec, by the way, completely ignore it. There we go. I think I just always assumed that I could stop. So I never really bothered. Like, you know, I just always went, well, yeah, I don't really have a problem. I could stop if I want to, but I don't. And it was only when I really had a go at trying to stop that I thought, this is harder than I thought. And I would start to get physical symptoms and I'd think, oh, okay, I've got to drink through that. That's not pleasant. So yeah, but I certainly didn't fit your stereotypical drinker. And I know a lot of my friends didn't notice it. Because, I mean, the closest ones probably did, but I was very good at showing up as this party girl or, you know, yeah, let's go out and have some fun. And I would be out with different people every night so that people didn't get suspicious. So people, I think, just thought that I loved to go out and have fun, which I did. I don't think they realized how much I needed that at that time.
The other thing you said there, just for people listening, when Lisa said, you know, you start to realize you have a problem when you try to stop. The other thing that happens around that time is resistance starts telling you that you don't want to stop. So I see that a lot as well. So you kind of look in the mirror and think you've got a problem, but your brain will say to you, nah, just keep on drinking, everything's all right. And it's that resistance, what he tells you to keep on drinking, when you're thinking you might have a problem, that's when the battle begins, and your stubbornness will come in very, very handy.
Well, you know, and it was a huge blocker for me, that I didn't want to see that there was anything wrong. And I remember a family member who, you know, I don't, same as you, like using the term alcoholic, but he would self-class himself as an alcoholic. And I remember him having that conversation with me on the phone, that, you know, the amount you're drinking would classify you as someone that had a problem. And I told him where to stick that and hung up the phone. And that was how the family confrontations went on it for a while. But I think the difficulty was, I knew deep down that I was drinking, not just because of drink, but I was using it to cope. And I always knew that, I think, deep down. And so when I started looking online and finding messages about alcoholism and a disease that I might have had since I was younger, it didn't fit with me.
Yeah.
Because there were periods of my life where I was very able to stop. And there were periods of my life where I found it more challenging, usually because of the emotions that came up when I did that. I wasn't happy, I'd be miserable, I'd be anxious, I'd be stressed, I wouldn't sleep. And so I would feel like me stopping drinking was bringing up more problems. So the messaging I was finding didn't connect for me. And I got frustrated because I thought, I wasn't born with this. I haven't had this problem all my life, but the last few years, it's definitely been a problem. So what's gone wrong?
I mean, something that Lisa says there for you listeners, which is super important, is Lisa realizes that she's having a problem with drink, that she's using it for other reasons just to have a laugh, right? She's on that point. So in a way, you start to realize, actually, I'm kind of using this like a bit of a drug, right? But there's something else that is super, super important. And if you become a member of Strive, this is how we actually help you become someone who doesn't drink alcohol, is unless alcoholism was an invisible, violent, and dominant belief system, unless we were bred to drink alcohol, Lisa would never have found herself in that position in the first place. So for example, Lisa's never in a spot ever in her life where she's going, yeah, I think I'm using heroin for all the wrong reasons here. I think I'm fucking banging cocaine up my nose for all the wrong reasons. Yeah. I mean, the cocaine thing may be, but I doubt the heroin thing. But the alcohol thing, it's like that. Alan Carr says it perfectly with a pitcher plant. You know, you get in there, you think it's great, and you start lapping it up, but then you get so fat and so stuck to this thing, you can't move out of it anymore, and all of a sudden the pitcher plant eats you alive. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is alcohol to a T.
Yeah, and I definitely think it's normalised in a way that no other drugs are. And, you know, I did end up in a rehab, and hated my 3 months there, as you'd expect. Again, the messaging didn't connect with what I was feeling. I didn't feel like where I was the right place, in a sense. I just wasn't, I was finding that I was worse. And that's not the same for everyone, but that was how it was for me, that I wasn't gelling with the message that was in there. And I definitely found what was interesting in there was studying other people, because I was one of the few people that was in there purely for drinking. There was a lot of other various drug users. And they were all experiencing similar thinking. And I think that was the point when it really started to connect for me, that, you know, it's not really about the substance we take whatsoever. It's about why we use it. We're all using it to escape or deal with, you know, something that we don't feel mentally able to deal with. And in that sense, alcohol is problematic because it's very excusable. Because it's normal, everyone drinks it. You know, if you said on a Friday night, oh God, I've had a really rough week at work, I need to go home and bang some cocaine up my nose, people would be like, what? Yeah. Whereas if you say, oh, I've had a really stressful week, can we go to the pub and get drunk? Everyone goes, yeah, sure, it's a great idea.
I was on the phone yesterday to a journalist from BBC Radio Wales. You know, they'd found the truth about alcohol and Strive and the podcast. And he was asking me questions to see if there's a story there, you know? And he asked me, would it be possible to go back to your old haunt? He said, I know you don't hang around with him anymore, but is there any one of your old friends that has a problem that would talk about it, you know? I said, are you kidding me? Everybody I used to know had a problem with alcohol. The problem is they don't know they've got a problem with alcohol. Yeah. And you don't know, I was saying to this guy, you don't know how problematic this problem is because you're probably part of it as well. And it really is like, we call it the death effect. You know, we got that term from Jeremy Griffith, an Australian evolutionary biologist. If people just have this death effect, they just cannot hear you. You know, it's no way that alcohol can be this much of a problem. No way, because everybody drinks it. It's everywhere. There's no issue. So it's really, really, really challenging.
It was like that Adrian Childs documentary that was on the BBC recently, where he only really realised he had a problem when they're doing all the liver tests and coming up with the fact that his liver's actually not in a great state. And he's going, gosh, I just never realised because I'm drinking what everyone else is drinking. And if, you know, you think about humans, we gravitate towards people that are, you know, that we like and that are fairly similar to us. Mm. And a lot of my friends were big drinkers. We all drank together at university. So I blended in for a lot of the time with what they were doing. So I couldn't see it. And it made it very hard when I got sober to go back into those environments, because it's then that you realize how normal alcohol is, that if you go to the pub and everyone's drinking and you order a non-alcoholic drink, people ask a question immediately as if there's a problem, you know, and you have to say something at that point, or I certainly felt I had to, oh, I'm driving, or, you know, and of course everyone's comeback is, oh, you can have one though. And that was the first time that I realized, wow, people really, really find it bizarre when somebody doesn't drink this. We have quite a cultural norm around this.
And we've only talked for the last 15 minutes, so I'll be careful not to project or assume it. But in the beginning, when we asked you these random questions, we learned a little bit about your personality type. You said about being stubborn. You talked in the beginning about being anxious when you're in school, despite being an overachiever. So I imagine then when you break out into the real world, trying not to drink alcohol, everybody else is, anxiety or having anxiety is a real issue, right?
Yeah. I felt so different and I didn't want to be.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was something, you know, that when I managed to get my mental health sorted, I suddenly started realizing all these blind spots that I wish I'd known when I was a teenager, because I just didn't. And I was constantly worried what people would think. I always wanted to fit in. And I would be independent with ideas and situations where I was comfortable to own that. But any situation where it was a little bit out of the comfort box or out of the ordinary, I wouldn't really step there because I didn't want to have to back myself on something that I would bring up anxiety about at that time. I so wanted to be liked and accepted. And you wouldn't have known that because I was such a personality at that time, but it was all just a massive front for the fact that I so desperately wanted to be the center of everything, because then at least my self-esteem was up a little bit.
Did you also get to a point then when you stopped drinking and things started to change you, where you actually couldn't remember who you were? So what I mean by that is, if you put on such a front when you're in school to hide from that anxiety and give off the impression you've got your shit together, does it become such a great double agent job that who is Lisa Lanson? You know, how do you piece your life back together? Was there a bit of that?
There was a lot of that because I think, you know, the irony is I didn't drink hugely in my teenage years, maybe on and off, but I certainly wasn't an early teen drinker. So probably, although I was anxious in those years, that was the most accurate part of my life, was those years. I would have said then the happiest point of my life were my uni years, but that was different because I was medicating all the anxiety so I could be the person that I absolutely wanted to be, because I was fueled by a substance that removed all my inhibitions.
Can I ask you a question there, then? Yeah. Sorry to pike in, but it's important. You said I was medicating myself so I could be the person I wanted to be. Yeah. But was that you?
In some senses, yes. And I think what I've learned to do now is do the things that I love and that fill me with joy without the substance. That was the lesson. So at university, I was going out there and I was being a social busy bee, and I was organizing events and, you know, winning awards and doing all these kind of things because I could go and party away the stress after, you know, and party away the anxiety. Or, you know, I was never a morning drinker at university. It didn't kick in then. So I would work hard, play hard. So the balance at that point was just about managing. And I would build up so much anxiety doing all this. You know, I was the kind of person that just took on way too much all the time, didn't manage my stress levels, but I could go out and party it away. So in a sense, I was the person I wanted to be, but I was just reacting quite badly to a lot of things in terms of creating hugely unnecessary amounts of anxiety and stress. But again, I'd medicate that. I'd have a real bender of a weekend and feel calm again.
And you got to rehab. You say earlier on, I know I'm going back to your stubbornness. I can't imagine being stubborn and being locked in a prison is going to really help you out. How important is it for any sort of recovery, whatever you want to call it, system, to recognize the individual personality traits and work with them in the way they want to be worked with?
Hugely. And so I think the first thing that I would say about treatment is that there are different treatments for different people, some more effective than others, but there are some people that might go to a treatment center and they swear it saved their life, and that I would never take that away from them. But I didn't get out of it what other people, you know, might have gotten out of it. I didn't like the messaging. It was a 12-step treatment center, and I personally didn't connect with that. It didn't make sense scientifically with what I was trying to read and psychologically about our brains and how we work. And so I think for me, where we hit a wall in treatment was that I wasn't given the space to explore those options. Some of the counselors in there were maybe better than others, but a lot of the time I was told to stop trying to find out about it, stop trying to read about it. You've just got to do these 12 steps and that's it. And I was like, but I want to find out what's going on. And I had a book confiscated from me in there that was trying to teach me more about the brain. And so that switched me off instantly. You know, that brought all the stubbornness in, because I was going, right, well, if you're not going to let me open my mind to find out what's going on in my head, why should I believe what you're telling me? Because you're not even giving me the space to explore. You know, it's my brain, it's my head. So again, you know, that's where stubbornness comes in, is that I was being told to accept something and not be given the space to intellectually examine it. And so I thought, right, no, I'm not having this. And I think then I really dug my heels in.
For people listening, I've been both critical of AA's dogma, but also empathic of it. Because at the time when I got into AA, I was thinking to myself, oh, this higher power stuff, this we're powerless, it's a disease, you know, all that kind of language, because of the personality type I have, it turns me off. So it's almost like maths. Like, I can't learn maths. It doesn't matter how often I try. It's not for me. Like, my brain switches off. And it's the same with AA. However, at the same time, when I developed the True About Alcohol philosophy, centered around alcoholism, my theory that it's an invisible, violent and dominant belief system, I then found myself being dogmatic, you know, like someone would say to me, there is value in alcohol. No, there isn't, you know, and it's fear that if the person who comes to you doesn't do what you tell them to do, because it worked for you, it's not going to work for them. And you have to develop slowly over time an understanding that different people need different help. Whether that is to say to someone, hey, if you don't believe in this AA thing, then go and spend some time with Lee over at Strive, or work with Lisa at Thrive, or, you know, Laura McCowan, or any one of the number of people who are out there. So I think that's super important just to mention that. How did you find Thrive then? What you talked a little bit about what didn't work, you know, the AA stuff and the rehab. What did work for you?
So the irony is I found Thrive before I ended up in rehab. So because my anxiety and eating problems were through the roof. So I got to the point where I was having maybe a bowl of soup a day. I was terrified 24/7 that I might get a virus or a bug and be ill. So I was super obsessive, super clean. And that's how I found the program, because it, you know, we have a specific program for that. And there's, you know, it's called emetophobia. And there was no other program out there that, you know, said they could cure emetophobia. So I initially did the program for that. And I remember the guy who wrote it, Rob Kelly, was my consultant, and said to me, you know, you realize that you're drinking because of X, Y, Z. And I was going, well, that can't be right. And I was dabbling in too many different camps. So I was doing all of the Thrive program work in relation to my emetophobia, but I would not believe that what was being said on addiction and drinking was anywhere near true. Because as far as I could see it, you know, then why are there these big organizations like AA that are so massive? And you know, compared to us, there must be something they know that we don't. And I sort of, again, stubbornness kicked in. And, you know, I told you right at the beginning, it's my undoing. My stubbornness kicked in and I just wouldn't believe that the program could fix my drinking or help with my drinking. So I think I had to sort of go down all the other paths to come back full circle to it. And really, I think it was rehab that did that for me, in that rehab was great for stopping me drinking for 3 months. Other than that, I was going crazy in there. I had nothing to do, particularly at weekends, there's nothing planned. I was just stuck with my head. But the more that I was watching people and the more that I was thinking about the things I'd learned in the program for emetophobia, which, you know, is applicable to any mental health problem that we experience, I was starting to put the pieces together myself and go, hang on a minute. You know, I've tried all the other treatments that are out there for drinking. I don't connect with them. Thrive is the Thrive program is the only thing I've connected with that made sense to me. Why am I not throwing myself fully into that? Because, you know, again, different treatments for different people, but that one always stuck with me. It was evidence-based, there was huge amounts of scientific research in it and at the back, and I just thought, do you know what, I need to get out of here and throw myself into that. And so I came out of treatment feeling pretty much, you know, physically better but mentally worse than when I'd gone in, and that's when I completely applied myself. You know, I'd managed to pretty much get over the phobia but just hadn't ever applied the thinking to my drinking. And so I came out and just went, right, that's it, full steam now. And I had a couple of wobbles, as you'd expect, you know, when I got out and had allowed myself to think in an unhelpful way, had a few drinks, had a little wobble, got myself back on track. But eventually everything started to click together. And I found that for me, I needed to know why I was drinking and work on that. Because whilst I was trying to fight off alcohol, which I believed was great and making me sociable and making things fun and helping me with anxiety, I was a bit screwed. Once I was getting rid of all the reasons why I wanted alcohol, I just didn't really want it anymore.
Okay. Can you tell people a little bit about what emetophobia?
Yeah.
What is it?
Emetophobia.
Emetophobia.
Yeah. So it's a mostly female phobia. About 95% of the sufferers are women. But it is a severe debilitating phobia of sickness, vomit, illness in general. So if you think about something like flying, if you've got a phobia of flying, you just don't fly. You've got a phobia of spiders, you might get someone else to get rid of them. Emetophobia is hugely, hugely bigger than that, because you can never be 100% certain it won't happen. So of course your anxiety levels are 24/7. So people are very obsessive about hygiene and cleanliness and where they go. They might not use public transport. They might not go near anyone that might have children or might be unwell. There are women who have not had children because of this phobia, you know, frightened of morning sickness, frightened of children getting unwell. So there, you know, I didn't even realize that was a phobia at the time. I just knew I found it a bit gross and horrible, but I was having so many panic attacks about it. It is the most severe phobia that we treat within the organization. That's what led to the drinking, really. In an early phase, that my anxiety around that was through the roof, and it got to the point where I was exhausted. I just was having panic attacks 5-10 times a day, and I realized quite quickly, wow, if I have a few drinks, that doesn't happen. And so, you know, eventually that was a coping mechanism. And then when I got rid of the emetophobia, I'd started to use alcohol to cope with so many other things that I didn't really drop the drinking.
Yeah, you get to the point where you've been using alcohol that much to cure your problems, that it's just something that you do and everything else becomes, it just is so ingrained in your life. I went to the library yesterday, public library, to take my 3-year-old daughter to a singing class. Aww. And I sat down in a little circle and two parents said, one parent said, oh, my little daughter's just recovered from chickenpox. And then the other one opposite her said, yeah, my daughter had chickenpox as well recently. And they're both there covered in spots. And I'm thinking, oh, no, that's all I need is for Zia to catch chickenpox. How does somebody suffering from that phobia react in that moment?
I have to be careful how to phrase it, because my initial reaction would be to say, from the many, many clients I now see with it myself, it's usually a very catastrophic overreaction. But in their heads, that reaction is completely justified, because they believe that sickness and illness is the possible worst thing in the world. Mm. You know, they many of them would rather die or throw themselves out of a moving car than be ill. So for them in that situation, it would be panic stations. You know, most of them may never go to nursery groups because of that, because they don't believe they could cope if a mum turned around and said, oh, my child's been really poorly recently. But in that situation, they might have a panic attack. They might get up and leave, take the children home, never go back, scrub everything, boil wash, bleach their clothes, you know, clean the house, whatever they've got to do to believe that they're having some control over this uncontrollable thing. And so what's interesting is when you look at the thinking patterns, there's a lot of similarities in a sense with drinking, in that there's very much control is a big part of it. That it's control with emetophobia over something you can control. And with my drinking, it was control over anxiety, control over, but both of them are revolving around this need to control your emotions with something external, because you don't believe you could do that yourself.
When I first read emetophobia, I thought it was the phobia of vomiting, and I guess is a part of it, but I thought it was just that, and it made me laugh because
there's loads of other stuff that comes.
When I stopped drinking, of course, a byproduct of being someone who doesn't drink alcohol is you don't puke up. Like I puked all the time. Like I would be puking, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 times a week. And then all of a sudden, I remember I hadn't been sick for like 5 years. And I went to some gym class or something. I overextended myself and I had a migraine that nearly led to me being sick. I remember freaking out, thinking, I can't be sick. I haven't been sick for 5 years. It was such a strange experience. I've been sick twice vomiting sick in 10 years. Yeah.
You know, that is the major issue for emetophobes, but because of worrying that everything will lead to vomiting, you know, even a cough or cold might really panic or worry them. You know, what if they cough so much that they're sick, or all of these things? So it's a particularly severe phobia because people are worrying and obsessing about it all the time. You know, it's on their brain no matter what they're doing. So of course, in that headspace, looking back at it with the beautiful hindsight, no wonder I drank.
Yeah.
In my head, I always thought that alcohol was such a strong, you know, almost antiseptic. I thought, well, if I drink that, that's going to kill any bacteria in my stomach. Brilliant. So I never linked it with sickness. I linked it with preventing it. The irony being, once I overcame the emetophobia and then started going through all the withdrawals for drinking, that was the only time really that I would try to stop drinking, because I thought, well, at least I can get through the withdrawals. I was sicker than I've ever been in my life.
Well, it's understandable how you would think that. If you just think of a classic movie scene of somebody who's just cut their stomach open, and then someone will say, grab me the whiskey. First, they'll drink it, then they'll ask them to drink it, then they'll pour it on the wound. So I can imagine how your brain just automatically says, oh, alcohol, yeah, it's going to kill everything in my body.
Yeah.
It does, but it, as well as you.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. That's a very warped belief system, I guess. But it was something that I just always assumed was true. I never thought about it that much. And you know, I wish I'd found the program when I was in my teens, because if I'd been able to knock that belief on the head and knock on the head all the reasons why I eventually needed to drink, all that low self-esteem and anxiety and stress and worry and being really obsessive and being really frightened of everything, if I could have built up all my emotional resources then, I don't think I would have ever needed to go down that path. But at the same time, I've learned more from it than probably any point in my life. You know, been a huge learning curve, just not one I'd advise repeating.
It says on your website, our program will teach you how to manage your thoughts, emotions and beliefs so that you're in control of your life. Talk a little bit more about that.
So I guess as a starting point, I would say that most of what, from my perspective and the organization's perspective, most of what we're taught about our mental health is not brilliantly accurate, in terms of we're often told that it's genetic and chemical, and that's just kind of it. You're born with it. It might develop later on, but once you've got it, your technique is to manage it better, you know, to cope with the symptoms of poor mental health. And really, it's nothing to do that at all. You know, if you think about how kids are brought up, they're like little sponges. You know, they're sucking up everything that they see around them. So they're born as a blank slate, really, in a lot of ways, certainly emotionally and behaviorally, and they learn and copy what they see around them. And so there's a huge amount of emotional responses and behaviors and insights and beliefs that we build from when we're very, very little. And as we grow, we continue to use those thinking styles. And if they're really healthy, helpful thinking styles, great. But if they're not, we can run into problems. And so I think at a foundation level, my psychological foundations, as we would call them, were pretty rocky, you know, not solid at all. So whilst life was cruising and fine, I'd be all right. But the minute something challenging, you know, came into my life, I would react in an unhelpful way. So that's why we talk about managing and emotions and reactions. I would create huge amounts of stress, completely blow things out of proportion, catastrophize everything. I had a belief I couldn't deal with anything, which was holding everything back. So any time a difficult situation came up, my default response was, I can't cope. I cannot cope with that. And of course, as humans, when we get into situations a lot that we don't believe we can cope with, the default response is to run away. So I got very used to then running away from things. So when we talk about managing emotions, it's about building up a set of really healthy thinking styles, really useful, empowering ways of looking at the world and yourself that enable you and equip you with skills to handle those situations so that you don't need life to be going really well all the time to be fine, that you know that throughout the ups and downs, you can manage your reactions to things. You don't have to create huge loads of stress. You don't need to blow things out of proportion. You're able to take action to manage your life and the situations in it really helpfully. So that for me was hugely important.
You talked, you talk a lot, and not a lot, but I picked it out on your website about symptoms. Talk about the importance of understanding what symptoms are in relation to addiction.
So again, I'm sure this is going to be slightly controversial for some in terms of an opinion, because, you know, that's not the way that we've viewed addiction and addictive behaviors for a long time. I would always argue that that an addiction is a symptom of poor thinking, not the other way around. That if you think about it at a really basic level, you are wanting to drink always for some reason, even if you don't know at the time what it is. It might be to relax you. It might be to have fun. It might be to fit in. It might be to sleep. For any of those reasons, that drinking becomes a symptom of a mental kind of processing that we're not doing as well as we could do. You know, if I, for example, had known at the time that I could cope with anything that was thrown at me and I'd built up the coping skills and the mental skills to be able to deal with that, I would never have hit that crisis point of, I can't cope, I need to drink, you know, because I would have gone, I can cope, I can manage this. So in a sense, my drinking was a symptom of a huge lack of coping skills and a lack of self-confidence, a huge amount of social anxiety, you know, trying to calm myself down. So that's why I say it's the symptoms are what you use the alcohol to manage, rather than the other way around. So I think where I struggled a lot with typical addiction psychology is they often talk about you having an addiction to the substance that you're not in control of, and that's just irreversible. And that didn't make sense to me, because I wasn't, particularly in the early years, drinking all the time. There would be certain situations where I could cope in and I wouldn't need it, but there would be certain situations where I didn't feel I could cope and I would use drink to medicate that. So my drinking was very much a symptom of poor thinking.
I was in Las Vegas recently and I met up with Holly, who's one of our Strive ambassadors, and her husband Mike. And Mike said to me, how do you manage this place being a former gambling addict, pornography addict, kind of drinking addict, smoke addict of everything? How do you manage being here in Vegas? Like, there's women walking past with butts hanging out, boobs hanging out. There's people taking drugs everywhere. There's bright lights everywhere. There's gambling pits. How do you manage, you know, with someone who has an addictive personality type, you know? And I was like, well, I don't really know if I do have an addictive personality type. And I want to explore that a bit with you, Lisa, right? I don't have the time or the patience or the willingness to go down the rabbit hole to learn and understand if I have an addictive personality type, because I'm going to a festival tomorrow and it's going to rain, so I need to organize for that. I've got a 3-year-old, an 18-year-old, I've got businesses to run, I've got wives to keep happy, I've got ex-wives to keep happy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So we only have a small amount of bandwidth, right?
Yeah.
So if I focus on, have I got an addictive personality, I need to ask myself, well, what's the value I'm going to get out of that? I can only see myself like getting a lot of problems out of it, really, because then I start going, fucking hell, I have got an addictive personality, and that means this is going to be difficult, and that's going to be difficult. Whereas it's much easier for me to say, I don't have an addictive personality at all. I'm just like everybody else. Like, I'm slightly fucked up, like everybody else. I panic and worry about everything, like everybody else. And everybody else in the world, like most people in the world, drink. So I drank, you know. Most people that I know who I hung around with gambled, so I gambled. Every single bloke I knew watched pornography, so I watched pornography. Well, there's a whole world got an addictive personality type. So what's your thoughts on how important it is to limit your bandwidth about what you think about?
I think you've made a super important point there, which is that diagnoses in a lot of cases don't offer as much value as we think they do, in that they box us into certain behavior. And so I definitely found that the very short limited amount of time when I believed I was an alcoholic, I felt more powerless than I'd ever felt in my life, because I thought it was some fixed part of my personality that couldn't change. So I don't think that definitions like that are either particularly well substantiated or particularly helpful, because you end up just believing you can't change it. Oh gosh, I've got an addictive personality. Well, you know, once I start gambling, I won't stop because that's me. You know, so you don't put the effort in to stop things or to find ways to learn how to not stop them if you don't know how at the time. The second thing I would say is, what's personality? You know, there are kids that have completely transformed from when they were young to how they are now. People can go through very challenging circumstances or situations in life, and it can change their personality for good or for better. You know, if you're a shy person and you believe that that is your personality and you'll never change it, you might never do anything to change that. But if you went, you know what, I'd like to be more confident, you could go to public speaking classes and you could watch YouTube videos and you could join loads of social clubs, and you'd probably change that part of your personality. But I think from a medical perspective, everyone seems to be so keen to box people into these tick box categories of you're an addictive personality. But I think it renders the person really powerless to do anything about it.
My daughter, 3-year-old Zia, every time, like we was in music class today, and the teacher said, does anyone want to sing in front of the class? Zia's like, yeah, I want to. Does anyone want to dance in front of the class? Yeah, I want to. Like, and I was getting a bit pissed off. I was like, Zia, shut up. Some other kid have a go. But if I take her into the park and some random person comes along and says, oh, hello, what's your name then? And she doesn't say anything. They say, oh, were you shy? Right? Now, she used to say, yeah, I'm shy. I taught her to say, no, just don't want to talk to you. Because she doesn't want to talk. She doesn't want to talk to him. Now, if she develops this, I'm shy, I'm shy, I'm shy, it's not going to be too long before we are trying to change part of that early growth personality where she says she's shy, right? So, you know, I'll be Mike. At the moment is a striver who's going through what used to be our intensive program. He's going through all the different coaching lessons. And one of the things he said that I said to him, what is the one thing that you fear most about stopping alcohol? And one of the things that Mike said was, I fear that I'll let my kids down and my wife down if I try to stop drinking and I don't do it. Like, I don't make it, right? And I said to Mike, the bigger fear is to carry on drinking. Because if you keep on drinking, then what kind of a role model are for your kids? Because like you just said, your kids pick up on everything around you, and who's around them more than anyone? Before they go to school, it's your parents, right? So, you know, I always said I never wanted to be like my dad. I so like my dad in so many ways, you know? So
yeah, you super important. Picked it up from an early age.
But I can change it. Like right now, I am an angry little motherfucker, right? But I can change that by having anger management classes, CBT classes. I could go to Fry probably and say, Lisa, I'm angry, help me. And you can help me. I'm seeing a therapist right now that's helping me with my anger issues, right? And I'm more aware of it. And I'm, you know, so I at the end of that, I'll be someone who is less angry. But here's the thing. Imagine when you were younger and you said to yourself, Lisa, oh, wow, like, I'm so different to everybody else because I'm suffering from so much anxiety. Imagine if somebody you trusted at that time would have been vulnerable enough to say to you, do you know what, Lisa? Every single person in your class is as anxious and as worried and as concerned as you are. It's just some people are better at ignoring it or turning it off or pretending, you know. it we're all fucked up. I mean, let's be honest. Like, we're all worried about something.
I think in a sense you're right, but I think a huge part of that is that, you know, we teach kids at school how to cook. We teach them how to solder. Who needs to know how to solder? You know, we teach them how to get fit and eat healthily and all these kind of things. We never once teach them how to manage their thinking and their minds. And it's the most powerful organ in their body. And so, you know, we're seeing such an explosion of mental health problems, not just addiction, but obviously we know that's one that we see a lot of. Particularly drinking, because it's so commonplace. It's so socially acceptable to go out and drink when you're struggling. But, you know, eating disorders, poor mental health in children, you know, we're looking at suicide rates for young kids that are just shooting up, which is so sad. Self-harm, anxiety, depression, all these kind of things. We're not teaching children how to manage. And so they're growing up with all this poor thinking and they're having to look for other ways to cope with that. So that surprised me.
On that, I'm just going to turn to my phone a minute. Ooh. I'm reading a book at the moment. I'm just going to pick it up on my Kindle.
Yeah.
I'm not texting anybody. It's called You, Your Child and Your School, Navigate Your Way to the Best Education by Ken Robinson, right? Okay. And I bought the book because right now, Zia's three. So me and Liza are thinking to ourselves, well, what school are we going to send her to? Yeah. And, you know, we've been thinking in the past when I had my son Jude, who's 18, it was, that's the school you're going to because it's the only school. That's the dentist you're going to. It's the only dentist. That's the doctor you're going to. It's the only doctor. You didn't walk into the dentist where I lived and said, I don't think I want mercury fillings. That's all you had, right? But now I'm older and a little bit wiser. It's like, oh, okay, what school can we send it to? And Ken Robinson says a really interesting thing in there. He says, here are all the things that we really want our children to learn, right? Let me see if I can get that up, because I think it would be good. I put a little note here. Let me just whiz past, see if I can find it very quickly. The school should provide a varied and balanced program that consciously cultivates your child's physical, emotional, cognitive, social, and spiritual development. But he has a caveat and says, but the school is not wholly responsible for raising your child. You are as parents. So I guess what I've been guilty of, Lisa, is saying, fucking education doesn't provide my kids with what they should do. What's the likelihood I'm going to change the education system? I'm much better off listening to podcasts like this and going, oh, wow. Like, how could I learn from what Lisa and Lee's saying and go back and parent my child differently so they can learn more about emotional intelligence, about communication, about, you know, all that things.
And the school system is designed to value those things, you know, and to a certain extent, that's not even necessarily the school's fault. You know, they are ranked amongst each other. The Ofsted ratings are hugely important. They're panicking. My mum's a teacher and panic stations over Ofsted is fairly normal for teachers. Their stress levels are through the roof. But we are comparing children on their output and not preparing them input wise for how do they manage their feelings around failure or not getting something right. How do we equip them with the skills to cope, to react well to things, to communicate? You know, it's little things. But if you think about it, a lot of parents that I see where their children are hugely struggling, the parent, bless them, won't even realize that there's any problem with what they're doing, or they're struggling so much that they've lost perspective on a huge part of it. But a lot of the time, you've got a parent that loves their child a huge amount, but fears anything happening to them, you know, and so they overprotect and kind of mollycoddle the child out of fear. So the child is never exposed to anything challenging and learns how to deal with that, learns how to cope with falling over and hurting themselves and crying and then dusting themselves off and getting back up again. They kind of become taught to be frightened of everything. So in a sense, parenting is hugely important because you can't change sometimes the schools they go to, and you can't change the things that happen to them in life, but you can teach them how to have the best emotional responses to it so that they're not knocked down every time something happens, you know, and that's massively important because I didn't have that, you know, so and you know, I don't think my mum or dad even really thought about it in those times. I think my mum was a little bit of a worrier and I was a little bit of a worrier, and we learned it from each other. And I grew up not knowing how to cope with anything challenging, and I would run away from it or try to overachieve so that I didn't feel so rubbish about myself. And had I learned to cope with those ups and downs better, I wouldn't have gone, I can't deal with this, I need a drink. I can't deal with this, I can't eat. I can't deal with this, I'm not going to go anywhere. You know, I made myself so introverted by the end of my drinking, which was, you know, the irony being that I was using drink to try and become the social person I wanted to be. And it ended up completely cutting me off from everyone and everything I loved. But, you know, that's because it's, again, nothing to do with the substance itself. I used it to medicate a lot of feelings that eventually, you know, were overbearing on the substance anyway. You know, my own mind was the thing that let me down.
And if you're listening to this as the parent of four kids and you're thinking to yourself, well, it's too late, I can't change, I've got a little story for you. It'll take me about a minute to tell you. I got an 18-year-old from a previous relationship. I have a 3-year-old right now. I mollycoddled and continue to mollycoddle sometimes my 18-year-old, right? I raised him to be born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Whenever he has an issue or he wants something, he goes to his mum or dad and one of them will give it to him. That's probably a byproduct of divorce, but it is what it is, right? I have a 3-year-old who I parent completely differently, right? Now, I am going to raise that child to understand what challenge is, to be autonomous, to understand emotions, to think away through problems and issues, and to cry and just experience feelings, right? What I'm saying, telling you here, folks, is it's never too late, right? Yeah. I fucked up with my first kid, and I'm lucky that he's turned out pretty all right, you know, tweak around the edges. But it's never too late. You can listen to this podcast now and you can reach out to Lisa on email or go to her website, say, please help me become a better parent, right? You can email me, Lee, can you help me be a better parent, right? It's never too late.
Oh, I love that. What a great story. And you know, it is just like you said, it's not that difficult to turn it around. Even if it feels hopeless now, a lot of the time it's a parent that's really, really frightened to put their foot down, you know. They want their kids to grow up as best as possible. They want their children to love them. They want to become their best friend. And sometimes it can be hard to say no. Mm. But actually sometimes taking that step back and saying to the child, what are you going to do about it? You know, how are you going to resolve this? Getting them to use their problem solving skills. They feel so proud when they've done it. They feel so happy and like, I did it. I fixed it. You know, you can't learn that from a book. You know,
especially through a divorce because, yeah. You know, like... Liza, my wife, will say to me regularly, Lee, why are you doing that for him? And I'll say, Liza, I wouldn't do that for Zia. I do it for Jude because I've missed half of his life. And I feel tremendous shame and guilt that I've missed half of his life. So when he wants something now, and I rarely see him, and I'm not in his life 99% of the time like his mum is, I feel a compulsion to help him. Otherwise, I'm the dad who never sees his son, who never gives him anything either. And it's I know part of that's a cop out, Lisa. I'm with that, and I know that I need to get beyond that and say, make it less about my ego, my shame, and my guilt, and just do it. I'm just raising an awareness that it's super duper challenging for people as well. You know,
absolutely. But that's why root cause of everything is so much more important. You know, that you're looking beyond that and going, hang on, why do I want to? It's not even about me giving him everything all the time. It's, you know, let's take that out of it. Why am I doing it? What's going on in my head that makes, and you said it perfectly, shame, guilt, you know, wanting your child to get those years back, essentially wanting him to love you and make up for lost time. That's the problem. Not necessarily what you're doing, but everything underneath it. And that's the difference between, you know, firefighting a lot of thoughts and then learning how to not build the fire in the first place. Learning what's the kindling for this problem at the end of the road here. You know, less focus on the problem and more focus on the why it's there in the first place.
It sounds like root cause analysis is an important part, component of thrive, right?
Yeah, but in terms of your thinking. I think our thinking has a huge amount to answer for. And when our, you know, the foundations of our psychology are not quite as stable as they could be. And again, it only takes 6 to 8 weeks to learn it. But when they're not as stable as they could be, there's always repercussions. You know, it's like a building that's got really shaky foundations. It's all right in great weather. But the minute that it hits a bit of a storm or windy weather, that building's wobbling all over the place or falling down entirely. So it's, you know, it's not the fault of the weather that the house fell down. It's the foundations that were not strong enough to support the house in the first place. So my argument would always be, yes, it's root cause, but not in terms of external things. You know, you didn't have a breakdown because you lost your job. You had a breakdown because you lost your job and your thinking styles were not helping your reaction to the situation. Mm. And I think, you know, the minute you understand that, it's so empowering because you're back in the driving seat. You understand that, you know what, no matter what happens in my life, I've got the mental skills and toolkit to handle it as best I can. It might be challenging, but I'm not going to be knocked down all the time. And so, you know, I've had a lot of challenges since I stopped drinking, but I've arguably reacted better in all of those situations than I've ever reacted to things in my life, which is a very odd situation to be in. But, you know, that's how it goes.
Can you give listeners a couple of examples of foundational changes that you made that enabled you to finally stop drinking through Thrive?
Self-esteem for me was one of the biggest. So in Thrive terms, we would describe your psychological foundations as being made up of three key things. So the first is your self-esteem. You know, what do you think of you? Not what everyone else thinks. What do you think of you on a daily and weekly and monthly basis? The second is your social confidence. How confident are you around people? How easily do you bow to social pressures? That kind of thing. And the third one is really key. And that's how powerful do you feel over yourself, your life, your emotions. So I had to fix all of those three to start seeing improvements. But I think for me, a huge part of that sense of power and control that I talk about was coping skills. I didn't feel emotionally I could deal with anything. And I think to a certain extent, I had to face some of that and realize the world didn't fall in and I could cope to start exposing myself to more without having a drink, kind of going, you know, I can do it. I can do it. Be uncomfortable, but I can do it. So that would be my number one. And I think my number two was building self-esteem, because so often I would drink on that. I drank on feelings of guilt, shame. I drank on feeling like a failure. I drank on feeling like I'd let people down. I drank on embarrassment. I drank on anything in my life that I thought I hadn't done well enough. I would give myself such a hard time and I'd feel so rubbish that I needed to escape that awful feeling and I'd drink.
How do you change that though?
You've got to build it. So we've got certain techniques in the program that teach you exactly how self-esteem is built and how we build it on a daily basis. But I think a huge part of it is understanding that self-esteem doesn't happen to us, that you don't either have good or bad self-esteem. Now, you might have somebody that has great self-esteem all the time and they don't realize how they've done it, but they are, without realizing it, building it every day. You know, they are focusing on the things that they are doing, not the things that they're not. They're giving themselves credit. They're praising themselves for effort, not always just outcome. You know, they are looking at themselves in a really healthy, positive, compassionate, understanding way. And I think a lot of the time I see it hugely with drinkers is they are so hard on themselves all the time. They can never get anything right. They always feel like a failure. And I definitely fell into that trap. But I never gave myself the space to just like myself and feel like I was doing okay.
Mm. It's funny. Self-esteem is a funny one with me, because it seems like the longer I go as someone who's not drinking, and it's been like 10 years now, and the more I learn and self-develop and grow, the more my low self-esteem reveals itself. Because I've always been like, someone would listen to this and go, he's a podcast host. Of course he's got high self-esteem. He loves himself. He's always fucking talking. Don't shut up. But at the root of many of my conflicts with my wife and issues that I have in life in general, it goes back to a low self-esteem. And I'm finding it's coming up more and more as I'm getting older. Why is that, Lisa? What's going on with me?
I don't think it's anything to do with age, I'm afraid. I think it's a habit, and it's a habit that you've not yet broken. That's all it is. So the longer you do it, the more natural it feels, I guess. But it's still just as easy to change. But, you know, I'm coming right full circle to one of the very first questions you asked me about social media. I feel like social media, if you see it for what it is fine, right? But most of us don't really see it for what it is. You know, if you think about it in terms of going down, if you owned a shop, right, and you want to get more customers in, you're going to put your best stock in your shop window, aren't you? You want people to be attracted to what you have to offer and want to come in and find out more. And I think people can often not see that the same thing is happening with social media, that, you know, in a shop window, you never put your offcuts on, you never put the things that didn't sell last season or the things that you're about to chuck in the bin if no one wants them. You put the best stuff out front. And people do the same with their social media. Now, that doesn't mean it's wrong. That doesn't mean they shouldn't ever do it. But it does mean it's a very distorted, it's like the difference between a picture and a video, isn't it? It's a second insight into someone's life. They are polishing up and finding the best, most attractive, most appealing picture for people to look at and sharing it. And if you understand that about social media and you enjoy it for what it is, then great. You know, but I think when you believe that that's real and that's all there is to it and everyone's living these fantastic, wonderful lives and you're not, you're using the things you're seeing on social media as a reason to beat yourself up for being a failure. So, of course, it comes straight back to self-esteem again.
Yeah, I've been doing a freelance course with Seth Godin, and one of the things they talked about is trying to get more money for what you're doing, right? And instead of saying to yourself, my hourly rate is X, so I'm going to charge you X, is to go to a company, because I'm a freelancer, right? So I can go to a company and I can say, well, actually, you're gonna earn X from this deal, so I want Y of it. Not my hourly. You know, if I'm going to earn you $1 million, then I want 50,000 is nothing, right? Yeah. So based on that, I write about poker. So I went to a poker company and I said, I've got this project that I want to do. I want £1,000 for it. Right. And then I sent the email and I said to myself, they're never going to give me £1,000 for it, but fuck it. You know, they'll come back and say, let's climb down, and they come back and said, yeah, we'll give you £1,000, right? So this morning when my landlord was in the kitchen, I got the email just as my landlord was there, and I whoa, you never guess what just happened. And I told him,
yeah,
and he left. And then I said to myself, what did I tell him that for? I told him because of my low self-esteem. I told him because I wanted to feel good. I wanted somebody to know that I'm not a waste of space in that moment. And social media is no different. I'm not on Facebook anymore, but when I was, all you would see is photographs of my beautiful children because I think they're beautiful and I want people to tell me that they're beautiful, really secretly. Yeah. You know, it's just all a load of nonsense.
It's looking for external validation, isn't it?
Yeah.
I see this a lot when people first come to see me, that they will sort of, oh, I came off social media, then I went back on it, then I came off it, then I went back on it. And I say, stop doing all of that, right? It's nothing to do with social media. And it's everything to do with the way that you look at it when you use it. If you absolutely understood it for what it was, you take it for what it is and not brood about the rest, right? But people don't view it like that. They view it as, oh my gosh, everyone else's lives are so great. Mine is so rubbish. What's wrong with me? You know, why aren't people liking this? Why aren't more people commenting? Mm. And if you view it like that, it is going to be hugely unhelpful for your mental health. So I would say change the way you look at it rather than change the thing itself.
Yeah. There you are. There's one. Lisa, change the way you look at it. Lee, fucking stick a bomb under it and blow it up. just before you go, because I know we're on the top of the hour, you're doing a year of fear, right?
I am.
I did a month of fear. I was going to do a year, but you know, I left it after a month. I started off thinking I'm going to be jumping out of planes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But as the month went along, I realized that it was all mental. Everything, every fear was mental. I didn't have to do any jumping out of planes. Tell me, what have you found? Yeah. What have been the biggest challenges?
I think the biggest, they've all been challenging in different ways. So far, the first thing I did was I recorded a podcast in January about my drinking journey. It's the first time I'd ever talked about it. And I put it all over my social media. That was my challenge. That was my social anxiety challenge. I don't care what people think. The story's out there. I want people to know about it now, you know, whether they agree or not. Then I've climbed the Eiffel Tower. I've held spiders and snakes. I've ridden a horse. I got thrown off two horses when I was younger and swore I'd never ride again.
Oh, wow.
I've been on a whole day of the worst roller coasters at Thorpe Park. And my brother came with me to make sure I went on them all. I did a 1.4 mile swim last weekend, the Bournemouth peer-to-peer swim in open sea. I went caving underground. And this weekend, I'm doing the fastest zip wire in the world in Wales, just over the Penrith Valley.
I've seen that one. Yeah, it looks very exciting.
And everyone goes, you must be a real adrenaline junkie. And I'm really not. I hate heights. I hate falling. I hate the feeling of speed. And that's why I'm doing them, because it's not about loving it. It's being able to tolerate uncomfortable situations. And that was why I used to drink, was that I didn't think I could tolerate anything uncomfortable. So every one of the challenges has to be uncomfortable in some kind of way, because it's teaching me emotional coping skills. It's showing me that I actually can cope with far more than I think I can. So
you have just changed one of the things we're going to do in Strive.
Ooh, okay.
So we, for our Strive members now going forward, I'm going to introduce a little, I'm going to create a little coaching module where people have to do a month of facing their fears, because I believe in everything that you just said there, I imagine, although some of the things might have been terrifying, you've experienced a lot of joy and excitement. So yeah. You can start to weed out what is actually good and what is not so good, right?
Yeah. And also, you know, you learn a lot about yourself, but you also learn the importance of processing it well in terms of looking back at it in a helpful way. So I think if you go through a challenging experience and then you go, oh my gosh, I should have done so much better. Why wasn't I calmer? Why wasn't I this? You're not going to use that experience in a good way. Whereas in my mind, it's progress, not perfection. It's always about like, how far have I come, you know, now anyway, rather than what didn't I do? So I went caving and I found the first 15 minutes really challenging.
Yeah.
I used to be very claustrophobic. Whereas it's about saying, do you know what? I did it though. I was really feared up at the start, but I did it anyway and I loved it. So well,
let's keep on with that theme of fear. I'm going to ask you two more questions.
Oh yeah, okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1 to 8, pick a number.
7.
Who of all your friends has the most power?
Well, that's a really difficult question, because I don't feel like any of them have power, but
I guess it depends how you define power.
Yeah. So
let's define power first, and that might help you.
I would say influence rather than power.
Okay.
And I would say, so I'm still really good friends with Rob Kelly, who wrote the Thrive Program. I work very closely with him now. And I credit him and the Thrive Program with changing and saving my life. And I trust his opinion when I'm, you know, if I ever have a little wobble or a struggle, I trust his opinion implicitly, because he knows me from the bad days. He knows how I think. And I trust him to tell me very honestly sometimes when I'm going wrong. But I would say two of my really close friends, one is Lindsay, who's in Australia at the minute. She's very direct and honest with me, and you know, has known me since I was 11. So I trust her to always be direct and honest. And I think my best friend, Kate, who lives in Cambridge, she is just probably the loveliest person you'll ever meet. I trust her to unconditionally love and support and help more than anyone. So she has a huge amount of influence in that sense, I guess, that she's always there. You know, both of those girls, you know, they will always be there, whatever you need.
Now you got three reasons to tell these three people to come and watch his podcast.
Yeah, I know, right?
last question, I'll let you go. How does being someone that doesn't drink alcohol make you feel?
Free.
Freedom.
Full of choices.
I like that.
I felt like I needed it before, and now that I know I don't need it, I have so much choice in my life that I never had.
Lisa Lanson, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. I'll make sure that everybody knows how to find you. But for those who are listening who can't be asked really to do anything of it, after they've listened to this, they're just going to listen to Tim Ferriss or some other proper podcast host. What's your website?
So my personal website is www.thrivewithlisa.co.uk, but the organization's website is www.thriveprogram.org. So either one.
And social media for when people are getting fed up of looking at their friends' bikinis or in male underwear.
Well, so winter then, yeah. Yeah, so I'm on most social media as Thrive with Lisa. I think Instagram's slightly different because the name was taken. So I think it's Thrive Lisa UK, but any combination of Thrive and Lisa will get you there.
Boom. All right, really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for being a guest on the Alcohol Addiction Podcast.
Thank you for having me.